Saturday, February the 29th. This weekend might well be called Operation Texas because of the presence in town of the Houston Symphony and of El Numero Uno, Darrell Royal, the coach of the number one team in all the nation. All the Texans in town are going, entertaining, talking, letting Washington know that Texas has invaded in full fold and victorious, both in culture and in athletics. Going to the beauty parlor this morning to get ready for the weekend cost me hearing Lyndon's first TV press conference. I did get to listen to the last part of it on radio, and it was strong and good, though I wouldn't say the A-plus performance that he often puts in when it's just a face-to-face encounter and not a TV radio. TV is still to him a sort of a betting war, and so I feel angry at myself that I didn't somehow work it out to be where I could watch it every moment and give him a critique, honest if not reassuring. We had invited all the members of the Houston Symphony, plus as many of those patrons who had accompanied them up here as we could get in touch with. We later learned that there were between 60 and 70 of those, and I think it finally ended by just a sort of a blanket invitation to them to come to the White House at 12:15 for a special tour, and then I was going to greet them in the state dining room for refreshments and a little visiting. That meant about 213 members strong, and this included the Texas State Society, or rather the Board of Directors of the Texas State Society, and all the officers thereof who were being sponsors for the Houston Symphony when it plays tonight in Constitution Hall. The angel of the symphony is a sort of the Duchess of Houston, in a cultural way, Miss Ima Hogg, the daughter of the famous Governor Hogg. Now well advanced in her 80s, she has been for 50 years the greatest backer, both with money and devotion, of the symphony. Bess had primed me to be on hand for the very moment of her arrival. She was coming in a wheelchair. I was standing by the door of the elevator. It opened, and to my amazement, out rolled not one wheelchair, but two. And in the lead one was Linda Wortham, the wife of our old friend Gus Wortham. In the next one was Miss Ima, very regal, very elderly, but very full of excitement and verve about what was going on. With her was the diminutive Sir John Barbaroli, the conductor of the orchestra, and Lady Barbaroli, and General and Mrs. Maurice Hirsch. General Hirsch is the manager. After a deferential greeting to everybody, I took Miss Hogg into the state dining room and asked her to hold court in one corner in her wheelchair where everybody would have the chance to come up and say hello to her. And then I got in a receiving line to meet all the members of the orchestra as they had completed their tour and came filing through. We'd had them go through in groups of 50 each so that they could have a really personally conducted tour with all of the charm and the tradition and the stories that the guides can so lovingly impart. Albert and Lyra Thomas were on hand, as were Bob and Hazel Casey, as sort of leaders of their flock of constituents. Lovely Barbara Burris was the person on the Texas State Society most responsible for making the arrangements for their appearance. And this was an excellent time also to have in the White House those other members of the Texas State Society that I may not get around to including at other parties. The Charlie Boatners were here, Bernice Greeter, the Jack Heights, the John Holtons, the Everett Hutchinsons, and of course the Texas of the State Society, Frank Eichard and Jean, and Ruth Lair, and naturally the Dale Millers. I'm always glad to see them here. And what an excellent time it was to have the Jimmy Pipkins. I told them that upstairs one of my most treasured things was my Lowestoft tureen, which the Texas X's had given me just about 2 years ago. The Claude Wilds and the Harvey Youngs were among the Texas State Society people present, and there were a good many other congressmen too, like the John Youngs. and the Jack Brooks. Just as I thought I had met everybody and spent enough time conversing with everybody, and the Sherry and Dubonnet had been around sufficiently, I was about to take my leave upstairs when my unpredictable husband walked in, and then everybody swarmed around him. And there was another great shaking of hands, and presently he got up and made a few-minute speech, welcoming them all and saying how proud we were of Houston and its achievement in the field of music. Then I slipped off upstairs, taking with me, for the luncheon that I had planned, Miss Ima Hogg, Sir John and Lady Barbaroli, the Maurice Hirshes, and we were going to meet Mrs. George Maurice Morris upstairs for two reasons. One, she's a great personal friend of Miss Ima's, and the second, my reason, is that she's a real authority on early American furniture and the owner of the Lindens, one of the loveliest homes in town, and a place I've always wanted to get to know better because it has a rare museum quality and it's lived in. Here again, Linden surprised me by joining us for lunch, and we reshuffled the place cards and the conversation. I didn't get quite as much time to discuss with Miss Ima as I would have liked the restoration that she has done on her father's old home. She's giving it to the state of Texas, and it is a museum, and her own home in Houston contains some great treasures, and when she departs the world, it will become the property of Houston. Sir John described how he had last been here to dinner in the time of President Roosevelt, how one gets together a symphony orchestra in a town like Houston, and he said there was a surprising amount of local talent around that you could find, but whenever they needed somebody to play a certain violin and couldn't find him right there, they looked around all over the United States into the total music market to find just the right fella and imported him. Mrs. Morris, Miss Ima, and I had a good time talking about whether the scenic panels of Revolutionary America in the family dining room by Zuber and Company were old ones, that is, about 1834, whether they were copies. I think we finally decided that some of the panels were old and some were new. Then we had a delightful walk through the hall, passing along among the Sheraton furniture, where Mrs. Morris pointed out a sofa that her brother-in-law had contributed to the White House, and Miss Ima said that she had been on the original committee for restoration appointed by Mrs. Kennedy, and that she had sent them a check, but she didn't know quite what use it had been put to. They both showed me a way you could feel under the seat of a Hepplewhite chair and find a certain curved reinforcement that proved that cabinet maker was following the lines of Hepplewhite, even underneath. After my luncheon guest departed, I had a little while to rest and sign mail. And then about 5 o'clock, Ann Clark of Austin, together with a friend, Mrs. Herring, who had been her roommate in college and was, what's more, her roommate on this trip. Anne's always taking little trips in the name of entertainment or culture. Arrived, and we had tea and talk. We reminisced about all our friends in Austin, their health and divorces, and then on some odd subjects, Bishop Quinn, who had confirmed me into the Episcopal Church. A most colorful man. The stage missed a good chance when he went into the church. When he used to stride down the aisle with his vestments flowing out behind him, singing loudly, "Onward, Christian soldiers," you could almost see the flaming sword that he held in his hand in front of him. Anne was telling a story about how when he'd been on exchange business of preaching up in Boston and was striding down the aisle, and the old ladies on each side were just muttering into their songbooks, mouthing the words, and he slapped one old lady on the back without missing a beat in his stride or his, more than three words in the song, and said, "Sing, sister, sing." It recalled to me one of the best integration stories I'd ever heard. It happened a long time ago, before the federal government ever took it up, before the Supreme Court decision, when the Episcopal Church was trying to get colored people and white people to join together in church work. That was a meeting of one of the ladies' organizations, and Bishop Quinn was urging Anne to attend and to be kindly to and hospitable to some of the colored women who were going to attend. Bishop Quinn said that Jesus Christ would have expected us to treat all of each other as brothers. And Anne said, "But Bishop Quinn, Jesus wasn't born in Greenville, Mississippi." Bishop Quinn paused a moment and then he said, "No, but he must have died there many times." After a while, the Darrell Royals arrived with their two sons, the coach looking properly victorious and bearing with him a wonderful color picture of the main tower of the university, lit up in orange to celebrate the final victory, with the number one outlined in the lights of the office building, stretched from top to bottom of that high shaft. It was a present to Linda Bird. Frank and Charmaine Denius were with them. I called Lyndon. He came over. Pretty soon Eloise and Homer came in.